Chapter 53 of This Country of Ours. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. This Country of Ours by H.E. Marshall. Chapter 53. The First Thrust. The Battle of Bunker Hill. The sword was at length unsheathed. There was no more doubt about it. There was to be a war between the mother country and her daughter states. And now, far and wide throughout the colonies, the call to arms was heard and answered. Farmers left their ploughs and seized their rifles, trappers forsook their hunting grounds, traders left their business and hastened to join the army. John Stark, a bold trapper learned in Indian ways and famous in Indian warfare, marched from New Hampshire at the head of several hundred men. Israel Putnam, more famous still for his deeds of daring in the Indian Wars, came too. He was busy on his farm at Pomfret, Connecticut, when the news of the fight at Lexington reached him. He was already a man of 57, but there and then he left his work and hastened round the neighboring farms, calling out the militia. Then, commanding them to follow him with all speed, he mounted his horse and turned its head towards Cambridge. Hour after hour throughout the night he rode onward, and as day dawned on the 21st of April, he galloped into Cambridge, having ridden 100 miles in 18 hours, without a change of horse. Handsome young Captain Benedict Arnold, half sailor, half merchant, gathered his men on New Haven Green, and when the general of militia bade him wait for regular orders, and refused to supply him with ammunition for his men, he threatened to break open the magazine if the ammunition was not forthcoming at once. So, seeing that nothing would restrain him, the general yielded, and Arnold, gallant and gay, with 60 men behind him, marched for Cambridge. Thus, day by day, men of all classes and of all ages poured in from the countryside, until an army of 16,000 was gathered round Boston. Meetings, too, were held throughout the country, where patriots urged the need of arming and fighting. In the Virginian Convention, Patrick Henry, the great orator, thrilled his hearers with his fiery eloquence. "We must fight," he cried. "I repeat it, we must fight. An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left us." Brilliantly, convincingly he spoke, and ended with the unforgettable words, "Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." His last exclamation, said one who heard him, was like the shout of the leader who turns back the rout of battle. But even yet the leaders of the country hoped to avoid a war. The Second Continental Congress met at Philadelphia on the 10th of May, and the members talked anxiously of ways and means to restore peace. But it was already too late, for the gathered army was no longer to be restrained, and the very day upon which Congress met, a British fortress had been seized by the colonists. The chain of lakes and rivers connecting the Hudson with the St. Lawrence was felt to be of great importance to the colonists. For if Britain had control of it, it would cut the colonies in two and stop intercourse between New England and the South. It would also give the British an easy route by which to bring troops and supplies from Canada. Among those who felt the importance of this route was Benedict Arnold, and the day after he arrived at Cambridge, he laid his ideas before the Massachusetts Committee of Safety, and asked to be allowed to attack the forts guarding this waterway. His request was granted. He was given the rank of colonel, and authority to raise a company of 400 men for the purpose. Arnold set out at once, but he soon found that he was not first in the field. For the people of Connecticut, too, had felt the value of this waterway, and Ethan Allen, with 150 volunteers, who went by the name of Green Mountain Boys, had set out for the same purpose. These Green Mountain Boys took their name from the district of Vermont, which means Green Mountain. That district, under the name of New Hampshire Grants, had been claimed by New York Colony. But the Green Mountain Boys had resisted the claim, and by force of arms proved their right to be considered a separate colony. Thus having settled their own little revolution, they were now ready to take part in the great one. At Castleton, Vermont, Arnold met Ethan Allen and his men and claimed the leadership of the expedition. But the Green Mountain Boys scouted the idea. They would fight under their own leader or not fight at all, they said, and as Arnold had gathered very few of his 400 men, he had to give way. So instead of leading the expedition, he joined it as a volunteer. This matter settled, the little company marched on to Lake Champlain, and in the middle of the night they arrived at the southern end, opposite Fort Ticonderoga. Here the lake is hardly more than a quarter of a mile wide, and the men began at once to row across. But they had only two or three boats, and when day began to dawn, only about 80 men had got over. With these, Allen decided to attack, for he feared if he waited till daylight that the garrison would be awake and would no doubt resist stubbornly. So, placing himself at the head of his men with Arnold beside him, he marched quickly and silently up the hill to the gateway of the fort. When the astonished sentinel saw this body of men creeping out of the morning dusk, he fired at their leader, but his gun missed fire, and he fled into the fort. After him dashed the colonists, uttering a loud, blood-curdling Indian yell as they reached the parade ground within the fort. The garrison, which consisted of about 40 men, was completely taken by surprise and yielded with little resistance. Then Allen marched to the door of the commandant's quarters, and striking 3 blows upon it with his sword hilt, commanded him to come forth and surrender. As Allen struck, the door was flung open, and half-dressed and half-awake, the commandant appeared. "In whose name," he demanded, "do you order me to surrender?" "In the name of the great Jehovah and the Continental Congress," thundered Allen. Really, the Continental Congress had nothing to do with the matter. The commandant could not know that, but he had only to look about him to see that the fort was already in the hands of the enemy. So, seeing no help for it, he yielded, and all his great stores of cannon and ammunition were sent to supply the needs of the New England army. 2 days after this, Crown Point, further down the lake, was also seized, for it was only guarded by 12 men. Here a small ship was found, and Arnold's chance to lead came, for he was a sailor, and going on board with his own men, he made a dash for St. John's at the northern end of the lake. When he was about 30 miles from the fort, the wind dropped, and his ship lay rocking idly on the water. Arnold, however, was not the man to be easily beaten. He had boats enough to carry 30 men, and with these he set off to row to the fort. All night the men bent to the oars, and at 6 o'clock in the morning they reached St. John's. Once more the fort was easily taken, for here, too, there were no more than 12 men. Arnold, however, was only just in time, for he learned from his prisoners that troops were expected from Canada. He felt, therefore, that St. John's was no safe place for him and his little band of 30, so he seized a small ship which lay in the harbor, sank everything else in the shape of a boat, and made off. And when the Canadian troops arrived next day, they found the fort deserted alike by friend and foe, and the boats which should have carried them on their way to Ticonderoga at the bottom of the lake. By these quick and bold attacks, the control of the great waterway was, for a time at least, in the hands of the colonists. It was, moreover, rendered useless to the British, for their boats being destroyed, they had no means of transporting soldiers southwards until new boats could be built. This caused a long delay, a delay very useful to the colonists. In the meantime, Allen was appointed commandant of Ticonderoga, and Arnold, with a little soreness at his heart, returned to Cambridge. He had been appointed leader of the expedition, but had been forced to join it as a volunteer, under another leader. His knowledge and dash had crowned the expedition with success, but another received the rewards and praise. When, however, the Continental Congress heard what had been done, it was rather taken aback. It was not at all sure at first whether it was a case for rewards or reprimands, for it was still vainly hoping for peace. So it ordered that an exact list of all cannon and supplies which had been captured should be made, in order that they might be given back to the mother country, when the restoration of the former harmony between Great Britain and these colonies shall render it prudent and consistent. Meanwhile, the new army grew daily larger. It was still almost entirely made up of New Englanders, but it was now called the Continental Army, and the Continental Congress appointed George Washington to be commander-in-chief. Washington was now a tall, handsome man, a little over 40. He was as modest as he was brave, and he accepted the great honor and heavy duties laid upon him with something of dread. "Since the Congress desire it," he said, "I will enter upon this momentous duty, and exert every power I possess in their service. But I beg it may be remembered by every gentleman in this room, that I this day declare, with the utmost sincerity, I do not think myself equal to the command I am honored with." Meantime, things had not been standing still. While Congress had been choosing a commander-in-chief, the army had been fighting. By this time, too, new troops had come out from England, and the British force was now 10,000 strong. Feeling sure that the Americans would not stand against such a force, Governor Gage issued a proclamation offering pardon to all who would lay down their arms, except Samuel Adams and John Hancock. These two, he said, were too bad to be forgiven. Instead, they prepared to take possession of the hills commanding Boston. It was at Bunker Hill that the first real battle of the war was fought. For Lexington had, after all, been a mere skirmish, only of importance because it was the first in this long and deadly war. The forts on Lake Champlain had been taken without the shedding of blood. The battle is called Bunker Hill, although it was really fought on Breed's Hill, which is quite close. The mistake of the name was made because the Americans had been sent to take possession of Bunker Hill, but instead took possession of Breed's Hill. It was during the night that the Americans took up their position on the hill, and when day dawned, and the British saw them there, they determined to dislodge them, and the battle began. Up the hill the British charged with splendid courage, only to be met and driven back by a withering fire from the American rifles. Their front files were mowed down, and the hillside was strewn with dead and dying. But again and yet again they came on. At the third charge they reached the top, for the Americans had used up all their ammunition and could fire no longer. Still they would not yield, and there was a fierce hand-to-hand fight before the Americans were driven from their trenches, and the hill was in possession of the British. For the British it was a hard-won victory, for they lost nearly three times as many men as the Americans, among them some gallant officers. As to the Americans, in spite of their defeat, they rejoiced, for they knew now what they could do. They knew they could stand up to the famous British regulars. And now, as Washington rode towards Charleston to take command of the army, news of this battle was brought to him. "Did our men fight?" asked Washington. And when he was told how well, his grave face lighted up. "Then the liberties of the country are safe," he cried. So with hope in his heart, Washington rode on, and at length, after a journey of 11 days, reached Cambridge, the headquarters of the army. The next day, the 3rd of July, the whole army was drawn up upon the plain, and mounted on a splendid white horse, Washington rode to the head of it. Under a great elm tree he wheeled his horse, and drawing his sword solemnly, took command of the army of the United Colonies. And as the blade glittered in the sunshine, a great shout went up from the soldiers. They were New Englanders, for the most part, but they welcomed their Virginian commander wholeheartedly. For were they not all Americans? Were they not all ready to stand, shoulder to shoulder, for the one great cause? But the army of which Washington had taken command was, perhaps, the rawest, worst-equipped army which ever marched into the field. The men had neither uniforms, tents, stores, nor ammunition. Many of them had no arms. There was no organization and little discipline. Even the exact numbers composing this army were not known. They were, in fact, as one of Washington's own officers said, only a gathering of brave, enthusiastic, undisciplined country lads. But out of this crowd of brave, enthusiastic men, Washington set himself to make an army fit to do great deeds. So he worked and rode and wrote unceasingly and unwearyingly. For he had not only to deal with the army, but with Congress also. He had to awaken them to the fact that the country had to do great deeds, and that to do them well, money, and a great deal of money, was needed. Meanwhile, George III also was making great preparations. More soldiers, he saw, were needed to subdue these rebel farmers. And as it was difficult to persuade Britons to go to fight their brothers, he hired a lot of Germans and sent them out to fight the Americans. Nothing hurt the Americans more than this. More than anything else, this act made them long to be independent. After this, there was no more talk of making friends. End of chapter 53, read by Kara Schallenberg in June 2010 in San Diego, California.